Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Jan Otto will be speaking on Busting the Boundaries, Mark 1, 21 to 31. So let's listen in on Jan.
My name is Jan Otto, and I'm a pastor who lives in Gig Harbor, Washington, and someone who really enjoys studying the Bible. And I'm doing some studies the next 2 weeks here at Holden on stories from Mark. Our title today is Busting the Boundaries. It's not, we were supposed to do this yesterday, but we got so caught up in other things that we didn't. And so today we're going to take a look at some passages in the first chapter of Mark. One story that begins with verse 20, and another story that begins with verse 40. And what I want to mention about Mark's gospel is that oftentimes he will write down two or three parallel stories. It seems like he likes to tell the same type of story two and sometimes three times in a pattern. And he does that on purpose. Every story shedding a little different insight. For example, in Mark, as the book continues, there is a place where there are three miracle stories. And it's a miracle story and then some action, and a miracle story and action, and a miracle story and action. The first miracle story deals with the recovery of sight to the blind. The next miracle story involves hearing, recovery of hearing, and the third deals with recovery of speech. And every miracle story then is followed by some events that tend to have significance in those areas. I call them the bridge miracles in Mark, and actually there's even a fourth one that is a miracle, but I haven't been able to find exactly what might be the bridges there. So that's just an example of how Mark tends to put his material here in order, and it means something. And today, there are two stories in this first chapter that in some ways set the tone for Jesus' life. One of them deals, the first one will deal with the synagogue, and the second one deals with the priesthood, and then in connection with that, the temple. First hour, we did pretty well with the synagogue. I don't know how far we got into the temple, but we tried. What I'd like us to do is read out loud this first story, starting in chapter, verse 21. And if someone would be willing to read Mark 1, 21 through 28, please.
They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, they entered the synagogue and taught. They were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Just then there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, Be silent and come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. They were all amazed, and they kept on asking one another, What is it? A teaching? A new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. At once his fame began to spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee.
As we start this morning, I invite you to look through what has just been read and to make mention of some of the words, and there's some really powerful words in this text, that jump out at you. What are some of the words that when this text was read or as you read it went, boom, boom, wow, that's significant.
New teaching.
Okay, new teaching. Others.
Unclean spirit.
Okay, unclean spirit. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Others. Your translation, immediately.
Immediately, every other word. Seems to be Mark's way of keeping us as the reader involved in the action as it moves very quickly from one event to another. And he uses that word about every other sentence, if not immediately the word and. And this, and that, and. Other words.
Authority,
okay. Powerful word. Other words?
Be silent.
Be silent. Others? We're in Mark 1, 21 through 28. Other words? Others? I'm going to just bracket those for a few moments. We'll come back to them. You'll see how these words tend to pop out. as we talk about some ideas here. And remember, my goal as a teacher has been not so much to talk about theology or what this means for Christian life on a daily basis or that, as much as to look deeply at the text itself and ask some questions. What is being really said here? What are the words that are being used? Does it have a foundation in the Old Testament somewhere? Is this something that Mark is going to repeat again elsewhere in the scriptures for other impact? So what we're going to do is we dig deeply into this and not so much on the surface. What I'm going to talk about today are some things that maybe you've not heard before about this particular text. And that's what I enjoy doing, is bringing a new possibility. And it's a possibility. Okay, what I'm not doing today is saying, this is the way you must understand the text. I'm saying, this is the way you might understand the text. What I want to talk about first, however, is this institution known as the synagogue. This is where Jesus goes. What do you know about the synagogue? What happens at a synagogue, or in Jesus' day, the synagogue?
Sacrifice.
What's that?
Sacrifice.
No, that's the temple. That's what we often do, is we confuse the synagogue and the temple. Now, if we keep those clear, then we'll have some concepts. And that's good that you've mentioned that.
Teaching.
It's a place of teaching. A synagogue is a house of teaching.
Like a seminary?
Mostly man, wasn't it?
Yes. A synagogue, anywhere there were 10 bar mitzvah, we don't know how much of this was done in Jesus' day, males, there could be a synagogue. Bar mitzvah is like confirmation.
Jewish people.
For Jewish boys in particular, and then now there's bas mitzvahs for women. Okay? But it's a house of teaching. The focal point in the synagogue is not sacrifice, it's scripture. And the learning of scripture. Other things. Who presided at the synagogue? Whose house was that? Whose domain was that? Of all the characters we always have mentioned the Bible.
Rabbi.
Okay, and what did we call them then? They were known as Pharisees. This movement gave way to what we have today as the rabbinic movement. When you go to a Jewish house of worship today, you have a rabbi who functions much more like a Pharisee as a teacher of scripture than as a priest, an offerer of sacrifice. So in order for us to understand what's happening in our text, we need to know where Jesus is and what's going on in this place. It's a house of teaching where males meet to learn, and it's not so much that the Pharisees were trained professionals, they weren't. They were lay people, like us. All of us are lay people, whether we're ordained or not. We all have that foundational laity that's so prevalent in Judaism, is that they're equals. The Pharisees were those who had something very important to do, and that was to take the scripture and to apply it to daily life.
Where do the scribes come in?
The scribes.
Because they're mentioned in the.
Yes, they are. I'm going to put them over here. I don't mess up my board. Okay. The scribes are often linked with the Pharisees, but sometimes you'll hear about the Pharisees and the scribes. Sometimes you'll hear about the Sadducees, the priests, and the scribes. Sometimes you'll hear about the scribes who are political, who are part of the house of Herod. Scribe means what it says. It's a writer. These were the literate people who could read and who could write. Not everyone could in Jesus' day. Many of the poorer areas, the men in the synagogue, were not able to learn the Hebrew scriptures. They memorized it instead of reading it. Part of a bar mitzvah today for a Jewish male is to learn Hebrew and to read from the Torah, from the scriptures on that Sunday. I was at a Jewish house of worship in Seattle recently, where two women were bas mitzvah, And they had learned the Hebrew over a period of years, and that morning stood up and read from the Torah, the books of Moses. And it was exciting. It was a real celebration. It was a neat time to be there. But scribes were literate. They could read and they could write. So therefore, they could be in the temple because they would record sacrifices and temple tax and anything that needed scribing. Okay? They could be in the political system as part of, you know, the king's court. And they could also be in the synagogue. Now, their role in the synagogue was a little more defined than these other two. In the synagogue, they were the people who copied the scriptures. They wrote them out, word by word, carefully. They were often used then as like we would use someone who was, say, a very high Greek scholar. And when we're studying our New Testament, we say, well, tell us what those original Greek words are and what they mean. And then they would be able to say, well, it says literally this. And so the scribes in Jesus' day at the synagogue were often asked, what does it say in Isaiah, the prophet? And they would quote, and quote with very much accuracy. Okay? But the Pharisees took it and applied it to life.
Were the Pharisees literate?
Yes. Yeah, but not to the same degree as probably the scribes, but they would have to be, I would assume. Have you seen the movie Yentl, where Barbara Streisand cuts off her hair, and she's not Barbara Streisand in the movie, but she's a Jewish woman whose father, behind the scenes in a much later period of time than Jesus' day, was teaching her the scriptures, and that was kind of a no-no, well, sort of a no-no. And so she gets so in love with the scriptures that she wants to go study, and when her father dies, she doesn't want to be a woman and do the woman thing. She wants to go and go to the yeshivas, the teaching places, and learn the scriptures. But to do it, she needs to change her identity. She becomes a male. And she goes away and she studies the scriptures. If you remember that movie, there is this discourse of arguing and wrangling and stretching and pulling and shooting bullets at each other. But it says in Isaiah, but Rabbi so-and-so said, yes, but what about Rabbi this? And that kind of interaction, that is typical of Pharisee Judaism. When Jesus encountered the Pharisees, it wasn't that they were always out to get him. That is a misunderstanding on our part. They came to him as a peer. And they said, what do you think about this? Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, were they trying to trap him? Probably. But then they did that to one another. That was just the way they were. There were two schools of Phariseeism, a conservative school and a more progressive school, Hillel and Shammai. And Jesus tends to be in the progressive school, from what we can tell by the teachings of his and by what the rabbis were in those days. But he went beyond that progressive school, and that was what got him in a little bit of trouble, as our text will talk about today. But the Pharisees, largely as lay people, were very popular. They were not hated by the people. People loved them. Why? Because they made religious life practical. We have something that we do in Christianity that we say and think about Jews that is wrong. It is dead wrong. And I don't know how many tapes in that Holden library have me saying this statement. Probably a lot. And I'm not the only one. There are a lot of other people that are continually to try to expand our understanding of Judaism by not always assuming certain stereotypes. And so I'm not hearing this as much as I used to, thankfully. But there's still that understanding that the way Jews earned salvation was by keeping the law. That is wrong. Their relationship with God was not based upon the law, upon obeying commandments. Their relationship with God was based upon what?
Covenant.
The covenant. Remember what that was? God came to Abraham way back when, and he said, Abraham, I will be your God, and you will be my people. And I will give you a great land, and I will give you all of these things. The relationship that the Jews had with God started as God's initiation. It didn't say God and say, well, you be my people if you do these things. He said, I will be your God, you will be my people. And it was settled. And Jews trust that. That's a matter of faith for them. But so then where does the law come in? Well, it comes in a very important spot. And that's where we need to make sure we distinguish the reason. Distinguish this proverb. How do I know all this? Well, I studied with a couple of rabbis. And they said, you Christians, you keep not talking to us about what we believe. Don't you think we ought to know? Sorry, you know? But it was Lutheran, it was even worse, because Luther was the one that really said that Jews were works righteous. He was involved in a battle with the Catholic Church of his day around that issue, and so whenever he read the Old Testament and all of Judaism and Jesus wrestling with the Pharisees, he kept seeing the Catholics in front of him on the page. He was like, no, leave that for Luther's time. But Jews, historically, have never been works righteous, ever. That's really foreign to who they are. Their relationship with God is based upon what's called a covenant, a statement of God's grace, if you will. It's God's grace in the relationship. He chooses. God chooses. And he did. That's why they're called the chosen people. Not because they chose, but because God chose. Okay? Now, what came after that, however, was the second. And I'm going to put Abraham up here because in Judaism, Abraham and Sarah are kind of the head patriarchs, if you will. They are kind of the figureheads of Judaism and its foundation, where it comes from, where God knew our name and where we knew God. But after that, there is someone else who comes along, and his name is Moses, and he is on the second high pinnacle. What does he introduce? What does God introduce through him? Let's put it that way.
Ten
Commandments. What were the Ten Commandments then for? If this established the relationship, what does this do to the relationship?
What is right or wrong?
Okay, that's the way we might want to look at it as Christians. What about Jews? How do they see it? This protects the relationship. If you want God to be your God, if you want to be sure to please this God who has chosen and loves you so freely, then God says, these are the things that you will do as a response to my choice of you. The Ten Commandments have always been a response in Judaism, not an initiation. So obey the commandments and you'll go to heaven. Jews don't believe that. If they do, I think some rabbi probably grabbed by the ear and straightened them out real quick. But I want to show you how this does tend to get brought down into some problems, and that was even evident in Jesus' day. This area of Ten Commandments is basically the world of the Pharisee. Their job is to apply each of those commandments to life. They were zealous, extremely zealous. Their number one motto was, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, who made these we need, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. That was their number one creed. Loving God with heart, soul, mind, strength. How do we do that, they asked. God gave us from Moses the Ten Commandments in order that we might know how to walk in the way of God. And so what they said is that, wow, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. What does it mean to keep the Sabbath day holy? And maybe someone would speak up and says, I believe that because of what God said in Genesis, it means that we ought to do no work on the Sabbath. Someone else would say, but what is work? Does it mean that I ought not just go to my paying job? No, someone else would say, it means that around the house, one must not labor either. But what is labor around the house? Is it the doing of dishes? Oh, I don't think it's even picking up a dish rag. Okay, you see what's happening? They are so zealous for these commandments and applying loving them that they continued to just talk them to death. And we end up with this fabric of other law around that. It was oral first. It was oral first, and it got written down into two books called the Mishnah, or in the Mishnah, and then that was divided out. So today, Rabbinic Judaism studies the books of these outer laws. What we could call it, what they called it, was building a fence. Meaning that they felt that if they could get all of this so defined around the commandments, then no one would even get close to breaking one of these, and therefore doing dishonor to the covenant. Let's not misjudge the motives of these people. Extremely religious and extremely zealous. In fact, in Matthew, Jesus says to his followers, unless your zeal exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's the scariest verse to me in the whole scriptures. It is. Because I know how zealous these people were, and they were zealous. Extremely zealous. But maybe their zealousness got a little bit off kilter at times. And I think it did. And in Jesus' day, what he was really focusing on was this stuff out here and how it began to be just done without any understanding of the relationship and what these laws intended to protect. They were just mechanically done and adhered to and rigidly, you know, and so that there was judgment made one to another upon who was doing the best job in taking care of what we would call now the fence. Ask your question. In the broadness of the Christian church, are there Christians that you would, perhaps with some fear of judgment, but at least in our understanding, are there Christians whom you would name or call or label as legalistic? I think so. We know who they are. We know what the type of piety tends to be. So too in Judaism. There were levels and levels and levels. They're as diverse as we are as a Christian church, they too. In Phariseeism, there were two branches. In fact, there were super Pharisees who were known as the Havarim, the separate ones. And they are often the ones Jesus encounters on the street and things because they go about their way very haughtily. And they are so sure that they are keepers of all of this that they can't even come near common folks, but for fear of being contaminated by them. All of this system and all of this structure is underneath this story that we read today. But to remember, and I hope that you can hold on to this, to understand that Judaism is not a works righteous religion. It's actually what it is. Put it this way. We are really good at separating secular and sacred, aren't we? We have our secular lives, and then our sacred lives tend to be things we do either at church or at home, maybe when we read the Bible or family devotions. Jews don't make that separation, not in the time of Jesus anyway. All of life is sacred. One does not live one's religious life at the temple or at the synagogue. Though synagogue and the temple were places of duty and responsibility. In the synagogue, the males of the household would go to learn about the application of Scripture and then to bring it home and teach the family. We have to understand some of these foundations when we read the New Testament, when we talk about men and women, because these are the things that are built upon that foundation. But it was a duty. Women were told that they were free from the synagogue. That's what I mean. It wasn't some sense of like privilege. If guys got to go to the synagogue, we could sit on the dishes. It was that they got to go do that thing. Okay? And when they come home, then we as a family will do this. The same with the temple. Both men and women went to the temple to offer sacrifices. So that place, however, was just a portion of what, again, one's responsibility and duty. The center of Jewish religious life has always been in one place. Where's that?
Home.
The home. The home is the center of religious life. It is where all the festivals of Judaism are celebrated and where Sabbath to Sabbath to Sabbath occurs. Everything else is external obligation. The home is where the religious center is. And in that sense, both men and women shared spiritual leadership. because as the men, men were responsible for the outside external observances and religious responsibilities, the women at home were responsible for keeping a kosher house, a clean house. Not clean in the sense of keeping the floor swept, but keeping a house that was, fitting and proper for a people of God. And when the Sabbath came around, her job on that, before the evening of Friday, was to be sure to get all of those unclean substances, yeast and all of that, out of the household to prepare the table for the arrival of the Sabbath, because they felt that the Messiah might come on that Sabbath. Very big responsibility. And then she is the one that lights the first Sabbath candle and begins the worship service. So men and women both have a role in religious leadership in Judaism. When Paul has to deal with this later, he's ending up in a culture where you all of a sudden got Gentile men and women coming into the church, and they don't have that same foundation, and I imagine all kinds of stuff broke loose. So he's got to figure out what he's going to do, so he talks a lot about, this is our tradition, he keeps saying. We don't know any other tradition. This is the tradition of the churches of God, meaning what we have known from Judaism is how we do this, how men and women operate. So we need to read those passages with an eye toward foundation, too. But in any case, I want to go back to this passage now. That was a long introduction, I'm sorry, but I think really important. And someone, would you please read it again, 21 through 28.
And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his teachings, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this, a new teaching? With authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee.
Starting with the first verse, they came to Capernaum. He's up in the Galilee area. He's out of Jerusalem. He's into an area where Judaism is a little more relaxed than around the Jerusalem area. And when the Sabbath comes, he enters into the synagogue and he teaches. Very, very typical for Jesus to go to the synagogue. He goes a lot, so does Paul. But you know, there's one thing that he doesn't do. As a good observant Jew, we never find him going to the temple to offer sacrifice. I find that really odd and extremely telling. But that's our next story. A little later in the chapter deals more with the priesthood and that institution. But to the synagogue, he would often go, and he could teach. It was something that was shared. You know, the synagogue was a place of peers and peer understanding. The scribes were those that were asked to quote the scriptures and with some accuracy. So in verse 22, it says, "They were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." What does that bring to your mind? What are some of your insights when you hear that phrase, that he teaches with authority? What might that mean?
Well, whatever he said, he really meant it. I mean, he put some force behind it. Like when you take a little child, you sit down or else.
Okay.
There was somehow something else that was, that maybe they didn't really realize that was coming through him, or something that they didn't really understand. Okay. Something else.
A different quality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Other things.
Maybe he was teaching without reference.
How so?
Well, you know, if they were discussing and talking with one another, I would imagine they had Torahs and so forth in front of them that they were using, and he probably came in with nothing and was, you know, was quoting and this type of thing without any kind of reference.
That's a really profound insight. And the reason I say that is that there's a few places where, in Matthew's gospel, where that's the way he talks. "You have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery, but I say to you," it's like, well, who in the world are you? I mean, that was kind of the attitude, because in a sense, They may have felt he was rather flippant or rather being rather brazen in that authority. Because you're right, the scribes would say, well, as it is quoted in the prophet Isaiah, the Pharisee would say, well, as Rabbi Hillel taught us, or as our dear Rabbi, you know, Moses said, or something, and they would quote with authority. The authority that they spoke with came from authority borrowed from the past. But this Jesus doesn't seem to always want to be referring to the past so much. He seems to be in the present tense saying, I say to you. You gonna say? Or are you giving me a salute?
I was trying to get a visual picture of what really went on there. The scribes were actually reading from written manuscripts, whereas I get a picture much like you do with the authority vested in him. You know, sort of thing. I see that contrast, which is probably makes more vivid the notion he does not teach as one of the scribes. You know, but make no mistake, there is another dimension.
Yeah. Anything else on this passage? Very interesting passage.
One question: when he was 12 years old and Mary and Joseph left him, was he in the synagogue that time?
Temple, but that's a different gospel. And remember the relationship that each of these authors, each of these Gospels have is that I look at them as preachers, and they're taking the baseline story of Jesus, and then they are writing it with understanding that is needed by the community of their time. When Mark is written, it's about the year AD 70, and by consensus of most scholarship today, at least in mainline circles. And around that time, the temple had been destroyed. And there was a lot of speculation about what the future of these Jewish institutions really was to be about. So, you know, in another gospel, the temple and or the synagogue may have a different role to play. But I'm trying to stay with just with Mark. It's a good question. But no, that he was at the temple when he was doing his, quote, teaching there. And that's not impossible either, because they could stand around the temple, on the temple courtyards, and they could teach whatever they wanted and did often. And often your messiahs would end up gathering around there doing their thing. I'm sorry, the movie that comes to mind is a really irreverent thing, and it's not really about Jesus, but it certainly is a picture about life in that times, and that's that goofy thing that came out called Life of Brian. And you got Jesus who's out and doing his own thing, but Brian is a parallel figure who goes through basically some of the same experiences. And you've got all these messiahs standing around saying, follow me, and follow me. I've got the holy gourd, and I've got the holy shoe, and off they go. Very humorous movie. If you can stand that kind of slapstick. Some, for some people, it's too close to their holy understandings of scriptures, but I thought it was still hilarious. Especially when you understand that Brian is not Jesus. He's often mistaken for Jesus everywhere he goes, but he's not Jesus. In any case, sorry about that irreverent moment. But so we end up with this authority and not as the scribes. Something that he's doing is teaching. He's in the house of teaching. Remember, synagogue, house of teaching. And he is teaching. And it's coming across in a new dimension, as someone so wonderfully put it. And then what happens? Immediately, or just then in my text, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. What do you make of that? How many of you have attended any one of Laurie Miller's sessions? Okay. Clean and unclean. Extremely important concept in this gospel. Extremely important concept in the scriptures. In the next story, which deals with a leper and the priesthood, that's a great place to talk about it again, and if we have a little time, we'll do that. We could go back to Leviticus and look at some codes, if you will, around what was known as purity laws or whatever. Certain people were unclean by diseases that they had or by places they had gone or things they had touched or food they had eaten or whatever. And I'll talk about that shortly. But just for a moment, to look at this unclean spirit is the fact that there is something unclean about this man and he happens to be in a place where he ought not be. Where is he? He's in the synagogue. Do you think for a minute these Pharisees who are so concerned and so zealous about keeping themselves pure and separate for the glory of God are going to have a man in the synagogue with an unclean spirit? Huh. No. Wrong. A rabbi gave me an insight into this text that I found helpful. And that's that often when we read this particular lesson, and don't think that rabbis don't read the New Testament, they do. It's really fun. They're great. They're really great. It's like, whoa, wow. Like these insights. But don't think for a moment, I think what we tend to do is we tend to think that unclean spirit means demon possession. Isn't that what you kind of jump to? This man is possessed by a demon. Mm-hmm. He has an unclean spirit. Well, what I find in Mark's gospel is that when he wants to talk about demon possession, he'll use the word demon possession. Oftentimes we think of an unclean spirit as a person with mental illness. Well, what else? Someone who's a lunatic or off his rocker. A few chapters later, Mark's going to talk about someone with demon possession. In fact, he talks about a little bit later about casting out demons. And there's a word for demon, there's a word for unclean spirit. They're not the same. What the rabbi told me was this. All people who have a demon have an unclean spirit. But not all people who have an unclean spirit have a demon. In other words, the category of unclean spirit is larger. And demon possession is a smaller category within that. In fact, he said, traditionally in Judaism, when we hear the phrase unclean spirits, what we hear is not these things. We hear someone who is a false teacher. Even Jesus, when he is in the midst of his teaching, is accused by the Pharisees of having an unclean spirit, meaning that he is a false teacher. He is not teaching the commandments and the application of the covenant in the way he ought to be, according to their view. And so, what the rabbi is suggesting here is that Mark is talking about perhaps some incidents in which Jesus casts out demons and other things of that category, but that he uses the phrase unclean spirit right there in the house of teaching intentionally. That this is a story about teaching. Who's teaching? Who is false? Who is true? Mark writes his gospel often using a device that's been known for some time. It's called a Markan sandwich. What that means is that there are a lot of places where Mark begins his story, and for, say, three verses, he starts a story, and then all of a sudden there's something else that happens in the midst of the story that doesn't maybe isn't even related, and then all of a sudden he finishes the story over here. And it's as if you could read these three verses and these three verses. If you didn't have this in the middle, it would still make sense. Does that a lot? And so the idea is that what Mark is doing is he's using this middle story to reflect upon what the outer story is about. Let's try that. See if it's a sandwich for you. In verse 21, we start, they came to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, he entered the synagogue and taught. They were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Jump to verse 27. They were all amazed, and they kept on asking one another, what is this, a new teaching with authority? Let's just stop there. You see how the theme of teaching kind of continues. The man's presence in the middle could or could not be there. It wouldn't matter. Following? Okay. So the concept of this sandwich idea is that whatever the story in the middle is, it's reflecting on the two outer portions. Now, if it's true, and like I'm saying, these are possibilities, that the man in the middle, the man in the synagogue, who wouldn't be in the synagogue if he had a demon. Understand that? He would not be in the synagogue if he had a demon. They would not allow him in the door. But if he is indeed someone who is a false teacher or represents that, then you have the contrast of the teaching with authority and the false teacher in the synagogue. Something else to notice in this, and why a lot of scholars feel this way, is that to notice what the man with the unclean spirit asks in verse 24. What have you to do with me, Jesus of Nazareth?
Us.
It is plural in the Greek. Have you come to destroy me? Destroy
us.
Us. It's plural in the Greek. I know who you are. The idea here, the possibility of another level of interpretation, below the miracle level, if you will, or above it, whichever way you'd like to go, is that perhaps what Mark is doing here is giving us a contrast of Jesus, the new teacher, or the teacher who will reform the teachings of Israel, with that which has been the synagogue teaching, symbolized by a man with an unclean spirit right in their midst who says, us and our. And that question that he asks, have you come to destroy us? Think about where the Markan people are in AD 70. The temple has just been destroyed. And they attributed that to the act of God, the Christians did, in Christ. So now the synagogue too, will that too be destroyed? Well, interesting theory, isn't it?
Why does Jesus tell him something to come out of him that he's false teaching?
Well, because all of that kind of stuff, unclean spirits, all of that kind of concept in your primitive people was considered to be a possession and a power within you. You know, I don't think the Hebrew people didn't quite have the same concept of a morality that we do, in a sense. I think that their understanding of the created order of people as they are created basically good. And so you would be good unless something was in you that was evil. And if you can take that which is evil out. In fact, take a look at a passage in Mark 7. I'll show you what I mean by this clean and unclean thing too. This is not going to make quite as much sense in this context, but it will a little bit later.
Even medically, you know, back then they were draining blood and things like that to get rid of.
You're right. Okay. I'm just going to we're going to look at this whole passage. We need to a little later. But 14 of 7:14, where Jesus says, and he called the crowd again and said to them, listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. He is trying to help people understand and break a primitive notion, if you will, that there are external things that you can eat, and if you eat them, they defile you. And he's trying to talk about a new concept of morality, which I think we more understand, which is that we are free agents and we have some choice in what we do. But that concept was that you were evil because there was something in you that you needed to get out. And so demon possession, unclean spirit, all of that has a much larger understanding than what we tend to look at as far as, you know, people with epilepsy or something like that. So look what happens here in this story, going back to Mark 1. What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. Well, congratulations, friends. You are now in good company. The first person in this gospel who knows who Jesus is, as you do, as the reader, is what? Man with an unclean spirit. Aren't we in good company? Great company. Okay. Remember in verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1, the gospel starts the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. You as the reader are the only one, basically, that know the secret before the story begins. And so now as the story goes along, you're going to find yourself in incredible company with the people who know. And, you know, it's just real nice to know that we're in that company. And that's good. Mark's doing that, I think, to break down some boundaries that we may have there. So in any case, he goes on, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, actually, the Greek is real strong here. It's basically, shut up. It's not, be silent. It's shut up. have the strong Jesus that we have found in this first part of this. This Jesus with some power exercises it. And come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. They were all amazed, and they kept on asking one another, what is this? A new teaching with authority. He just, see what I mean? He cast out a man with an unclean spirit, and they'll say, what is this? Wow, what a deed of power. He threw out a demon. They say, what is this? A new teaching. What's that a new teaching? But see, the unclean, now the unclean spirit, I think, in this a little broader way of understanding, is a man that maybe is symbolizing the false teaching of the synagogue, which has gone awry into getting so caught up in that fence, in those, you know, little details, and that road observance. We don't know why we're doing this, but we're doing it because we're supposed to, and aren't we holy? And is going to call them back to a deeper understanding of what faith and trust in God is. What is this? A new teaching. And then there's two versions to read this. A new teaching with authority, or with authority he commands even the unclean spirits and they obey him. And at once his fame began to spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee. Well, what do you think of that? I'm going to be quiet for a second and get your response. What did you hear in all of that? Does it make sense to you? Is it too far-fetched? Is it useful or helpful?
Well, thinking down the line with what you said is going to come further on, that he's going to be called an unclean spirit, that he's going to have an unclean spirit. The one line here, with authority, he commands even the unclean spirits, which would put him at the top of the unclean spirit, the leader of the unclean spirits, in someone's eye further in the book.
Right, and that's what we did, that was yesterday or the day before, when we talked about that strong man. Is that that's how they were so convinced that Jesus must, if he casts out demons, he must be of Satan. And that he's just ordering his orderlies around. And basically when Jesus says, he says, hey, a house divided against itself can't stand. And if Satan is against himself, Satan will fall too. And so then he goes on to say, I'm not of Satan, basically. I am the strong man. I am the one who binds up the strong man so I can plunder the house of Satan. At least one idea of that. So, yeah, that's an argument that tended to follow as one possibility. They didn't want to give him credit as being from God, so let's make him of Satan. There's only two choices, right? He's either one or the other. And that's that one thing, too. Remember when, a little later, when they come to him and they ask him a question, and so he asks them a question back. He says, well, you tell me first. Was John's baptism of God or was it of human origin? And they went and they conferred and they said, oh, what are we going to do? If we say it was of God, then he'll ask us why we didn't believe John. And if we say it's of human origin, well, the people are going to get mad because they really like John the Baptist. So they came back and said, we don't know. And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you. You answer your question either. Okay. So you've got this little game of words and things going on here. And again, Jesus is living at that Pharisee type he does what Pharisees do. That's how he converses with them, except when he talks with authority.
Well, this verse where it says the unclean spirit convulsed him and crying with a loud voice came out of him. Are we talking about some kind of verbal discourse that's going on? I mean, was this person won over by what Jesus said? And, you know, they were exchanging very lively kinds of conversation or argument, and then this person realized Jesus was an authority.
Well, as far as that one phrase, you mean?
Yeah.
Crying with a loud voice, you know? I don't know, other than it's probably some sort of physical manifestation to show that the cleaning out of the false teaching has happened. You know, a sense of convulsion. We don't know what was said or what the loud voice cried or anything, but that tends to be the pattern. You know, again, primitive understanding of how that happens is there's something inside, and you have to have some way of showing out that what is inside is changed.
Like a Pentecostal type of thing.
Fine, okay. That's right. Yeah, that's fine. That'd be okay with me.
The authority is the Greek word dunamis.
Yes. I think so. Let's use it.
I always,
go ahead.
Intrigued by that word because, you know, when you come into our contemporary understanding, which the root of that word is, we're talking about dynamic. And I think it's a marvelous word to picture what happens
when God or Jesus comes into a situation and there's this dynamic change, you know.
It's actually exousia.
Exousia.
Yeah, so it's more related to the power of the... Interesting choice. Okay, I'm going to zip you over to Mark 40 for a few moments. We only have about 9 minutes left. And there's a story there that is going to be a parallel story. Again, someone who is in the category of unclean. This time a leper. A leper came to him, begging him and kneeling, said to him, "If you choose, you can make me clean." Mark 140. What did I say? Mark 40.
Mark 140. Question.
16 chapters, Mark. 140. A leper came to him, begging him and kneeling, said, he said to him, "If you choose, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I do choose, be made clean." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was made clean. After sternly warning him, he sent him away at once, saying to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them." But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the word so that Jesus could no longer go into a town openly, but stayed out in the country. And people came to him from every quarter. Talk to you a little bit about clean and unclean. Have any of you been to any of Lori Miller's sessions? Okay. Did I already ask this question?
Yeah.
Yes, here we go. Yeah. I've done this twice, obviously, as a live memorex. Lori has been talking about something known as purity. And this is the notion of clean and unclean. This whole mode, well, let's go back a little bit to some foundational things a little bit before that might be of help. The scientific understanding of the universe of the time of Mark was one of cause and effect. For everything that happens, there is a cause, and every cause will have its effect. So there was a lot, basically what they understood was what happens, and if they could find the cause for it, it was understood, it was not a mystery. Okay? Anything that they could not understand tended to get put into a category that of that which is unknown or mysterious or whatever. They had a certain word for that. Every culture has these things. The Polynesian culture has things that are mana, I believe is the word, and that means ordinary and commonplace. And then they have things they call taboo. You know what taboos are, don't you? We tend to have things, that's a taboo. Okay. That comes to us out of the Polynesian culture. Hebrew culture wasn't much different in the sense that, and I'm talking primitive times, real primitive times, prior to Mark, prior probably to Abraham even, you have things that happen in life. You have birth, and you have death, and you have all kinds of things that you have a hard time explaining why this happens. Do you know how long it must have taken them to figure out how a baby was born? Because the act occurred 9 months earlier. They probably got it from watching the animals. And then they figured out that's what they were doing. Otherwise, whatever. And I think in the most primitive times, birth was something so mysterious, it got named as something that was holy and mysterious and not touchable. And the same with death. Why does one moment somebody sin and all of a sudden they're dead? How does that happen? Mystery, not understood. Gail mentioned blood. The concept of where life was in your blood. That's what they believe. Not in your heart, beating your heart, some cells or some chemical thing going on, but in your blood. And your blood was alive, and when it poured out on the ground, it had a voice and it cried out for you to have your blood avenged if that had been spilled by somebody. All this blood crying out all the time caused massive civil wars. But that was their concept. So what happens is that all of these things that were mysterious were put in a category basically of untouchable. Don't touch, stay away from. Over time, that category began to be called unclean. Now, go back with me for a second to the book of Leviticus. Again, To understand our New Testament, we need to understand our foundations. I don't know too many people that run down to the Bible bookstore and buy a commentary on Leviticus. It's not exactly a book I think most people enjoy reading, because it's basically a book dealing with worship, but also with how life is lived in terms of clean and unclean. Go to chapter 11. If you read from chapter 11 to probably just about to chapter 20 in Leviticus, you'll have a very good understanding of what's going on in the culture and the society of Jesus' time. Chapter 11 starts in Leviticus. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, from all the land animals, these are the creatures that you may eat. Any animal that has divided hooves and is cleft-footed and chews the cud, such you may eat. But among those that chew the cud or have divided hooves, you shall not eat the following: the camel, for even though it chews the cud, it does not have divided hooves, it is unclean for you. The rock badger, for even though it chews the cud, it does not have divided hooves, and so forth." And you go on, you see all these are clean and unclean. Just kind of look through chapter 11. There's things that I'm starting at 9 around fishes with fins and scales. Certain things you can eat, certain things you can't. 13, you've got the birds you can eat. 20, winged insects. They're all detestable and unclean. 24, by these you shall become unclean. This is verse 24. Verse 24. If you give a number, it'll be a verse and not a chapter. "By these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches the carcass of any of them shall be unclean until the evening. And whoever carries any part of the carcass of any of them shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening." And it goes on about the unclean things in this chapter. Move over to chapter 12 now. Look what's unclean there. "If a woman conceives and bears a male child, she shall be ceremonially unclean 7 days, as at the time of her menstruation. She shall be unclean." And then it goes on and on and on about what that's about. So all these things that I think you can look back earlier than the time this was written and begin to see in the root of things that are mysterious and not understood, this concept of unclean. For most of the earliest years, it had no moral connotation. It had no ethical connotation. It were things, again, I think God gave the people to protect them. Animals and things to stay away from eating, to not make one sick. I mean, the preservation of the chosen people were important to God. But there were other things like the blood kinds of understandings that continue on. Women in childbirth, menstruation, men in ejaculation, all of these things are unclean. Men as well as women. Men didn't tend to have as big a penalties, or at least have to do quite as much as the women did, but that's kind of the way it goes sometimes, ladies. In chapter 13, this is where we get the deal with leprosy. And it was not just Hansen's disease, as we understand, but any kind of disease, skin disease, that might be communicable. And so, look what happens here. Look who's given the authority. When a person, 13:2, has on the skin of his body a swelling or an eruption or a spot, and it turns into a leprous disease on the skin of his body, he shall be brought to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons the priests. The priest shall examine the disease on the skin of the body, and if the hair in the diseased area has turned white and the disease appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is a leprous disease. After the priest has examined him, he shall pronounce him ceremonially unclean. And then you go on about, and then they have this whole description here, which would be good for you to read if you're interested in this, to see how they discern certain kinds of skin conditions. If you were found to be totally unclean, you were taken and put outside, what's called outside the camp. You were put outside the people. You were put away. And you were not allowed to come in and be anywhere near the people, because one of the concepts they had was that one could touch who was unclean another and make that other person unclean too. In the book of Haggai, it says that the question was asked, if a holy person touches an unholy person, can they make that person holy? And the answer is no. But then they say, if an unclean person touches a clean person, can it make them unclean? And the answer is yes. The power of uncleanness was incredible. So if you look through Leviticus here, you'll see that for the first few chapters, you're dealing with unclean things, And then starting at about 17 or 18, you're dealing with clean and unclean relationships, which included Gentiles and foreigners, and all kinds of people were put in that category. And so as we read our New Testament, we're finding Jesus encountering clean and unclean people all the time. And if we don't have the background, we may not know it. And this is scandalous in and of itself. And so in this chapter, or in Mark 1, starting in verse 40, he actually reaches out and he touches the leper. Ooh, that is just, I mean, that's just incredible. And what's more incredible is he doesn't become unclean himself. At least he may in the eyes of those watching, the priests or Pharisees, but in terms of his own understanding himself, he doesn't consider himself unclean. So anyway, what we really need to do is look at this story tomorrow if you're still here. If you're not, what I want to say is this kind of summary sentence. And that's that the job of determining clean and unclean belong to one group. Guess who? Priests. They had the power to look at you and determine whether you were clean or unclean. And with that kind of power, do you know what kind of oppression occurred? Horrendous oppression. And that's where Jesus has a lot of his life in this gospel, fighting this system of clean and unclean. And you just keep reading and reading. The more you read of Mark, understanding clean and unclean, the more this is going to just jump out at you and glare.